I'm Peter Adamson, and you're listening to the History of Philosophy podcast, brought to you with the support of the Philosophy Department at King's College London and the LMU in Munich, online at historyofphilosophy.net. Today's episode, Lambs to the Slaughter, Debating the New World. When people who were living through the Renaissance noticed the newness of their own period, they often pointed to a trio of discoveries that symbolized the changing times: gunpowder, the printing press, and what they called the New World. It's a sobering thought that all three unleashed mass death. The lethality of gunpowder speaks loudly for itself. The printing press is less obviously dangerous, but can take some of the blame for creating the conditions that led to the wars of religion. But of these three, the real killer was the encounter between Europeans and the peoples of the Caribbean and Americas. It's a controversial question how many people were living there before contact occurred and what percentage of the Americans died as a result. At the higher end of estimates, we may be talking about the largest extermination in human history. Some scholars have put the pre-contact population at more than 100 million and suggested that as many as 90 or 95% of these people were annihilated. Even much lower estimates of both population and death rate would give us numbers well into the millions. It's also debated whether to call this a genocide. Those who are reluctant to do so argue that the vast majority of deaths were caused unintentionally, simply by spreading unfamiliar diseases like smallpox. This explanation in terms of disease is what holds sway in the popular imagination, but there's no doubt that the Europeans, and especially the Spanish, deliberately caused staggering numbers of deaths through warfare and pitiless enslavement. As the Caribbean historian Eric Williams wrote, it has been said of the Spanish conquistadors that first they fell on their knees, and then they fell on the Aborigines. The sheer destruction caused by the European invaders was, as Williams here suggests, compounded by their hypocrisy. Theirs was an endeavor sanctioned by the Catholic Church, whose 1493 decision to give the Castilian crown jurisdiction over the Americas came with the caveat that they never inflict hardships or dangers on the people who lived there. Given the brutality that the Spanish nonetheless exercised under this license, you could be forgiven for assuming that their attitude was entirely cynical, that they gave no thought to whether their activities could be justified. Actually, though, the Spanish were keen to reassure themselves that what they were doing was perfectly legitimate. Farcically, the conquistadors would read out in Latin a document to the perplexed inhabitants of the land they were seizing, laying out the juridical basis for what they were doing. This coupling of legal nicety and notorious atrocity may remind us of the Spanish Inquisition. And, in fact, it was Ferdinand and Isabella, the same monarchs who started the Inquisition and expelled the Jews from Spain, who first sought to justify the colonial enterprise. In 1501, Isabella wrote to the governor of Hispaniola, the island now split into Haiti and the Dominican Republic, to say that she wished the Indians to be well treated as our subjects and our vassals. This is reminiscent of the concern we saw her expressing for the fate of the Spanish Jews, and if the concern was sincere, it was similarly ineffective. In 1504, and again in 1512, Ferdinand organized meetings of jurists who were asked to provide a rationale for what everyone knew the Spanish were going to do anyway, extract every last bit of value out of the newly encountered lands without regard to the welfare of its inhabitants. It's here that, to its eternal shame, philosophy becomes relevant. In putting together their arguments, colonial apologists drew on the most reliable and authoritative of sources, namely Aristotle. When writing the first book of his Politics, he had been in the similar situation of wanting to give a rational explanation for something we nowadays find inexcusable, namely slavery. If you're feeling charitable, the idea he came up with can be read as an attempt to restrict or even reform the practice. Some people are naturally slaves, the implication being that it would be inappropriate to enslave people who do not have such a defective nature. Natural slaves lack independent rational control and cannot achieve happiness, the true goal of human life, so they in fact benefit from having a master to take charge of them, exerting from outside the sort of discipline and reasonable choices that they cannot manage on their own. Of course, the master benefits too, since the arrangement lets him get use out of the slave, who in Aristotle's terms functions as a kind of living tool. One can also find in Aristotle the notion that whole peoples are slavish. He goes so far as to suggest that all non-Greeks, or barbarians, are natural slaves, perhaps because of the unfavorable climate in which they live. This would resonate with something that Plato says in his Republic, namely that it is wrong for Greeks to enslave other Greeks, better for them to go after the barbarians. Reports about the indigenous Americans brought back by European explorers suggested to some intellectuals that these peoples fell squarely into the category of Aristotle's natural slaves and barbarians. Thus, the Scottish scholastic John Mayer, whom we met in episode 430, wrote that these people live like beasts, and this has now been demonstrated by experience, wherefore the first person to conquer them justly rules over them, because they are by nature slaves. Juan López de Palacios Rubios gave similar advice to the Spanish crown in 1413. The idolatry and hedonism of the Amerindians justified their subjugation. Another Spanish jurist, Juan de Matienzo, speculated that in their lack of rationality, the native peoples were no different from the animals, for they are ruled by their passions. For them, there is no tomorrow, and they are content that they have enough to eat and drink for a week. But then the conquistadors reached Mexico and Peru and started sending home astonished descriptions of the great cities they found there, polities that weren't so unlike the city-states described by Plato and Aristotle. These were people with laws, commerce, a writing system, and elaborate religious beliefs. No fair-minded observer could still believe that the indigenous people were tantamount to animals, though, as we'll see shortly, at least one observer who was not so fair-minded managed to believe it nevertheless. Someone who took the evidence seriously was Francisco de Vitoria, a Dominican who will be pivotal in later episodes when we get to the so-called School of Salamanca and the renewal of scholastic philosophy in the Iberian Peninsula. Vitoria was, among other things, a profound legal thinker and revisited the status of the Native Americans from this perspective. Though he had studied with students of John Mayer at Paris, Vitoria found it hard to agree with Mayer that these people were all natural slaves in light of the more recent accounts of their sophisticated culture, what he called the rational order in their affairs. On the other hand, to deny that European Christians had legitimate authority in the Americas would be of great detriment to the Spanish princes and is thus unacceptable to us. Vitoria concluded, therefore, that the indigenous people were fully rational, but had the misfortune to inhabit defective societies. This explained why they engaged in such notorious practices as cannibalism, sodomy, and human sacrifice. The existence of such customs in the Americas showed that its people were unable fully to grasp the requirements of the natural law, whose principles should be inscribed in all humans and give them guidance in moral and political affairs. Even without the benefit of Christian revelation, these people should have known better than to eat each other and sacrifice one another to gods. They might be able to build cities, but they did not know how to treat their fellow humans. Vitoria reasoned that when it came to such things, the indigenous were not unlike grown children who needed guidance from the morally superior Spanish. And yes, you can go ahead and enjoy the irony here. Still, this didn't mean that the Spanish could simply exploit them without restrictions. As Vitoria said, the rightful authority of the Europeans over the Americans should be used to provide them with ethical and religious education, as you might offer to a child who has not yet been properly socialized. This would not be slavery, but benevolent oversight. His conclusion fit well with the Spanish encomienda system. The Native Americans were not formally enslaved, and their encomendero was not a master to whom these people legally belonged. He was supposed to Christianize them, not use them as living tools. Yet this provided an excuse for forcing them together into the encomiendas so that they could not fall back into their old cultural and religious ways. The Spanish proceeded to work them to death, mining silver and gold, meting out savage punishment to anyone who stepped out of line. All perfectly legal. Which brings us to that observer who was not so fair-minded, a man who was always cast as the villain when telling the story of 16th century debates over the New World. His name was Juan Ginés de Sepúlveda, and apart from his involvement in these debates, he was a scholar of a type that's become very familiar to us. Like so many from around Europe, he went to study in Italy, acquiring there humanist philological skills and a profound knowledge of ancient philosophy. Having studied with no less a figure than Pietro Pomponazzi, he set himself the task of producing new Latin versions of works by Aristotle and his late ancient commentator, Alexander of Aphrodisias. Not coincidentally, one of the texts he translated was The Politics, which included those remarks by Aristotle about natural slavery. Sepúlveda seems to have been a combative man. For example, he published a list of errors made by a rival Aristotle translator. This provides some context for the provocative and scathing approach he adopted when he did turn to write about the so-called Affair of the Indies. He did so in a dialogue, pitting a critic against a defender of Spanish colonialism. Reminding us that we're in the context of the Counter-Reformation, Sepúlveda makes the critical opponent a Lutheran German named Leopold. arguing on behalf of the Spanish, is Democrates, who spares no effort in describing the Amerindians as base and animalistic creatures in whom hardly a vestige of humanity remains. More favorable reports from Mesoamerica have done nothing to convince Sepúlveda otherwise. Yes, the people there build cities, but so do bees build their hives and spiders their webs. Abominations like cannibalism and human sacrifice show that they are indeed naturally slaves, as does their cowardice, something shown by the paltry defense put up against the conquistadors by Montezuma. Indeed, the Europeans' treatment of these people was not turning them into slaves. Rather, they were already slaves by nature before the Europeans turned up, and the Spanish were just treating them as such. The Amerindians had no right to resist this treatment, since it was entirely just. For, Sepúlveda writes, those whose natural condition is such they must obey others, if they refuse that lordship and there is no other recourse, may be subdued by arms. And this war is just, according to the opinion of the most eminent philosophers. Despite the allusion to Aristotle, he's doing more here than just reiterating the natural slavery defense. He's adding, in more medieval terminology, that the Native Americans' lowly condition licenses a just war against them, a war that will ultimately be to their benefit. Even once they are defeated, they should perpetually remain under European domination, for what greater benefit and advantage could befall those barbarians than their submission to rule of those who, with their prudence, virtue, and religion, have converted them from barbarians and barely men into humans and civilized men to the extent that they can be. The outstanding virtues of the Spanish in particular makes them the best choice to undertake this task. Notice that even so extreme a figure as Sepúlveda was still concerned to find a legal and even moral rationale for the colonial enterprise. He was able to invoke precedent using medieval concepts that had been developed in the context of the Crusades. As already established then, non-Christian peoples do have property rights and can have legitimate political arrangements, but Christians may, under certain circumstances, wage war against them, as when the infidels violate the natural law. While Sepúlveda's conclusions were not that different from those reached by others who had written on the topic, his radical tone made the dialogue seem needlessly provocative. So when he applied for a royal license to publish it, there were misgivings. A panel was convened to consider the matter, with the judges including another important Spanish scholastic thinker, Domingo de Soto. The event was held at Valladolid in 1550, with Sepúlveda offering a short and somewhat toned-down defense of his position. The scholar chosen to rebut him did so at great length, going on for several days. Soto said the opponent seemed to be trying to refute not just Sepúlveda's dialogue, but everything he had ever written, and with some success in that the result of the panel was inconclusive, meaning that Sepúlveda did not get his license. As for the indefatigable critic, he is the man always cast as the hero of this story, Bartolomé de las Casas. Born in Seville in 1484, he had traveled to Santo Domingo in what is now Haiti in 1502. Still on that side of the Atlantic, he experienced a road to Damascus moment in 1511, when he saw his fellow Dominican friar, Antonio Montesino, give a speech excoriating the Spaniards for their mistreatment of the Native Americans. "Are these not humans?" demanded Montesino. "Do they not have rational souls? Are you not obliged to love them as yourselves?" According to de las Casas, the Europeans present were stunned. Some were furious, others were incorrigible, some were saddened, but as far as I could tell, none were converted. Apart, that is, from de las Casas himself. He gave up his slaves and returned with Montesino to Spain, where he embarked on a relentless campaign to convince the authorities to crack down on the violent excesses of the conquistadors. While he wrote a number of works in this vein, the most frequently read, thanks to its relative and uncharacteristic brevity, is his short account of the destruction of the Indies. He's no less biting in his attacks on the Spanish colonialists than Sepúlveda was in his portrayal of the so-called Indians. For de las Casas, it is the conquistadors who are the real barbarians and savages, as shown by the elaborate and merciless tortures they have inflicted on the native peoples, which are itemized in detail in the short account, dividing the evidence by geographical region. De las Casas emphasizes that, having been there, he can provide first-person testimony about these crimes, from roasting men alive to cutting off limbs just for the fun of it. By contrast, the natives are docile lambs, physically delicate and naturally virtuous rather than naturally slavish, given to asceticism, almost like the desert fathers of Christian antiquity. The proof is that they have never raised a hand against the Europeans, unless sorely provoked, and are ripe for speedy conversion to Christianity given their inborn gentleness and respect for the divine. De las Casas excuses human sacrifice as an admittedly misguided attempt to express this innate sentiment. "We consider," he wrote, "that the Indians are truly men, and that they are not only capable of understanding the Catholic faith, but, according to our information, they desire exceedingly to receive it." Unfortunately, the missionary efforts of the Spanish have been at best half-hearted and undermined by their own greed. De las Casas tells with bitter relish a story about one indigenous leader who solemnly explained to his people that the god worshipped by the Christians is gold. And implicitly confirming that the colonialists did indeed see their unfortunate victims as beastly, he remarks of one encomiendo that he was no more interested in the indoctrination and salvation of the Indians than if they were sticks and stones or cats and dogs, and that in his experience, there had been in general no more effort to bring Christianity to these people than there was to teach the faith to the mares and horses and other beasts of the field. His conclusions, which he would have also put forward against Sepúlveda at Valladolid, were unambiguous. As he put it in another work, The Apologetic History, the Native Americans were fully capable of governing themselves and of living like men of good intelligence, and more than others, well-ordered, sensible, prudent, and rational. Like Vitoria and Sepúlveda, he based himself on legal principles here. In this case, he emphasized the principle that what touches all must be approved by all. The Spanish could exercise dominion over the Americans only if the Americans agreed, and even the Pope could not unilaterally grant authority over this foreign land. So in short, you can see why De las Casas has been widely celebrated. He seems a one-man refutation of the relativist notion that people in earlier times were operating in a different moral universe, making it impossible for us to judge them for their endorsement of such barbarities as slavery and the encomienda system. After all, here was someone who already in the middle of the 16th century was saying more or less what a modern observer might say if transported to Valladolid and asked to give their opinion on the matter. Nor was he alone, by the way. Remember that we saw Montaigne, in his ironically entitled essay On Cannibals, similarly adopting a perspective sympathetic to the Amerindians. So it does seem fair to ask, if Montaigne and De las Casas managed such moral clarity, what was wrong with their contemporaries? But of course, De las Casas was no time traveler, and a closer look turns up some more problematic attitudes on his part. His uniformly favorable portrayal of the Indians as meek and virtuous lambs is the exact reverse of Sepúlveda's portrayal of them as debauched and irrational, which sounds good until we notice that he could not conceive of variation in individual ethical character amongst the so-called Indians any more than Sepúlveda could. Rather, both of them saw these people as a morally homogeneous group, and this despite an appreciation of other kinds of variation, for example, in the languages they speak. So it's been observed that De las Casas was engaging in racialist, though not racist, thinking. Furthermore, we should not overlook his central emphasis on the Christianization of the indigenous peoples. Lambs need a shepherd, after all, and De las Casas saw the Amerindians primarily as a flock awaiting religious instruction. Revealing here is the contrast he draws between this case and that of the Muslims. Because the latter group have been exposed to Christianity and explicitly rejected it, they are enemies of the faith and subject to warfare from the European Christian powers. That logic wouldn't apply in the Americas, at least not yet. But one wonders what De las Casas would have said if, after a generation or two, he found that the peoples of the New World were still adhering to their old ways and traditional religious beliefs. As one scholar has said, pointing to this aspect of De las Casas's position, he tolerated the Indians because he believed they would assimilate. The case of De las Casas illustrates, then, the balance we need to strike in reading historical texts that deal with troubling and still contentious issues like colonialism and slavery. On the one hand, we want to adopt a critical approach. On the other, we don't want to fall into outright anachronism. This balance certainly allows for the application of concepts and analytical tools that have emerged much more recently in the history of philosophy, and that's what I want to do next time. An emerging subdiscipline of philosophy that we have not explicitly touched on in the podcast so far is philosophy of disability. The ideas developed by philosophers working in this field turn out to be illuminating for the topic we've just been discussing, and you can immediately see why. Effectively, authors like Sepúlveda were arguing that the entire Amerindian population was defective or disabled in comparison to Europeans, who were, of course, taken to be perfect and fully abled humans. Next time, I'm going to be interviewing Scott Williams, the editor of a volume of collected essays that applies insights from the philosophy of disability to this and other pre-modern topics. So join me for that next time here on The History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps.